Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. It is my privilege to welcome Justine Froker on the show today. Justine is an author, speaker, and accidental butterfly farmer. Justine, I am so excited. We've been trying to get this on the books for several months now.
I'm so excited.
I'm so excited as well. And just excited to have you here and just sharing all your wisdom and all your insights. And I just know that your story is going to touch the lives of our listeners. So let's get started because we've got more things to talk about than we probably have the time to do today. And go back to the beginning and just tell us a little bit about how you grew up.
So a lot of people are kind of surprised. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, no stoplight. I milked cows for my job in my senior year of high school.
Interesting.
So to me, like when I went to Kirksville, Missouri for college to Truman State, that was the city. Now, St. Louis is a big city for me.
Yes.
So I grew up small town, and I think probably the most defining part of my growing up is I was a dancer. That's what I was supposed to do. I was going to grow up and go to college and dance. And then I started having debilitating pain around the age of 11. And I was misdiagnosed for about a year and a half until they finally found a broken back. And I ended up having two back surgeries in high school. The biggest piece being that I spent a year of high school in a body cast. It was that small town, though, that was such the saving grace. The small town that after those back surgeries, I was like, peace out, I'm done, I'm out. And yet it was the saving grace to that story because, I mean, my teachers came to my house to teach me.
Oh, wow.
You know, like it was—
To get you through.
To get me through. You know, when you look back on your life of what were those, what we would call the hard parts of our story, I no longer call those parts of my story hard, and that's fairly recent. They are the big parts of my story because hard doesn't honor how far I've come. It doesn't glorify God. It doesn't serve the world. Like when we stay stuck in our heart. And so I try not to like, yep, I've had two back surgeries, spent a year of my life in high school. It led me into an infertility journey. And now I teach people how to rise from the ashes and write their story.
Yeah, hard is hard.
Hard is hard.
It's hard is hard. Uh-huh. But you know what? So much of our learnings and our transformation can come from those hard times.
Uh-huh.
But it is hard when you're going through it. It definitely is. Well, you got some funny stories about that. And the body cast and a good friend of yours that helped you,
do
your business.
Uh-huh. I do. My first book ever, Upward, you know, people are like, how do you write a book? And I was like, well, when you grow up being told you should write a book because you spent a year of your life in a body cast. But like the most common question I would get, how'd you go to the bathroom?
Right.
Like, or how did you get transport? Like, how do we drive 40 minutes to University of Iowa Hospital three times a week? Because I could not bend at the waist. I was either standing or lying down. The body cast was from chin to knees for 6 months each surgery. And so we rallied and we got creative and we laughed. And I had just done an Instagram post last week. I found a picture from probably right when I started having pain and like what I would have told her and how I would have cupped her face in my hands and said, you're all right. And it's going to be okay. And it's going to get so dark. And it's okay. Like, you are okay. You are loved. I see you. Keep going. But, like, when I was trying to find that picture, I couldn't find anything of that time of my life. And my parents will say we didn't take pictures. It wasn't a happy time of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It was debilitating. It was hard. We all felt invisible. Doctors would not listen to us. I mean, my first diagnosis is what helped me become a therapist. I was told I had conversion hysteria.
Really?
Yeah. That psychosomatically my brain was making up the pain and that there was nothing physically wrong. And they made me go see a sports psychologist. And I was 11 or 12. And I remember thinking, what you do is pretty cool. And I filed it away, you know, like I filed it, but I'm going to dance. This is going to be fine. Because no one told me to stop dancing at that point.
Sure.
And then eventually they found the two cracks on a year old x-ray with grade 4 slippage of the vertebra. So surgery was the only option. Mm-hmm. But it ultimately led me to where I am. Yeah, it was not in my head. And so at all, but like it was then when I lost faith in myself. I lost faith that this would be okay. I lost faith in other people. I was really, really alone. Yes, people rallied. And how do you truly understand a girl stuck in a body cast? It's a really hard thing to practice empathy with, right?
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about empathy.
That thread is throughout my whole life, really.
Your whole life, right. Well, let's kind of move forward. So you became an accidental butterfly farmer, you and your husband, Chad.
And the weirdest and coolest hobby ever. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, we want to know all about it. And we're all going to want to be butterfly farmers now after we hear your story. Because you say the lessons that you learned from a monarch butterfly, you go into it in great detail. So tell us a little bit about that and how that even came to be.
My husband and I ended our infertility journey. We're coming up on 7 years of saying enough. We're done. The money's gone. The hearts are broken. And so we chose to end our journey without kids. We had lost 3 babies in the journey of IVF. We never felt called to adoption. I don't think that that's like a black and white decision. Mm-hmm. You never know what's going to come in your life. But
sure.
We knew that we were not signing up for that journey for the tens of thousands of dollars that were already gone.
Yeah, you said that your bank account was depleted.
It was gone.
Yeah. You had no money for adoption.
Well, because a lot of people don't understand how expensive IVF is or how common it is. 1 in 8 couples struggles to conceive. 1 in 4 pregnancies ends in a loss. And 1 in 160 pregnancies or deliveries end with a child born still. And a lot of that 1 in 4 and 1 in 6 end up going into the infertility journey because they have trouble conceiving again. Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at infertility treatments, we're looking at $8,000 to $15,000 per round. Not everyone has the ability to take out loans for that or to get a grant. And so adoption's really very much the same
financial journey along with
the loss journey. And so I talk a lot about the advocacy of adoption is not a fix to infertility. Stopping our journey and saying we're done was also not a fix to it because it's just grief. And I believe we all have grief. No one's life has turned out how they hoped, dreamed, and planned.
Right.
And I'd like to meet the person who says that it did.
Yes.
Because I'm going to therapize them a little bit. Kind of say, oh, what's really happening?
Yeah,
what's going on? Are you just powering through?
Sure.
But when we ended our infertility journey, I had to dig my way out of the hole. I had to dig my way out of grief. And so I really started to practice what I had been teaching to my clients for the last 12 years because I'd been in private practice as a licensed professional counselor back then. And I started with self-care. I started digging my way out, just taking care of the actual vessel of the body. But then I also knew the data. People who have hobbies are happier people.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, to add to it, couples who learn a hobby together are happier couples. Learn the hobby, not necessarily have one person teach it to the other. That's definitely
learning it together.
Learning it together.
Well, like, you know, I'm reminded of that adage that says couples that play together stay together, couples that pray together stay together. But, you know, having something that you're doing together like that, whatever it might be. So you and Chad had never been butterfly farmers before, and you decide, let's go on this journey.
Yeah.
Because
we live on a whole acre in Creve Coeur, which is such a blessing. And so people often, when they hear that we raise monarch butterflies, they're like, I used to see those everywhere. You don't anymore because we've lost 90% of the population in the last 25 years. So in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, especially, is on the Monarch Highway of where they migrate from Canada all the way down to Mexico. So we're right along their migration pathway. So it was kind of like, okay, we have all this land. Let's plant milkweed, which is what they
eat.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a weed. It's a total weed.
Okay.
And you cannot get rid of it.
Is it pretty prolific?
It will spread. And it's beautiful. It smells like the flowers smell so good. But that's what the caterpillars eat.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't treat it.
There's
no chemicals because that's also what's destroying the monarchs. What's destroying the monarchs are clearing of land and then really pesticides. And so we were like, let's just plant a garden. Let's learn about how to do this. Let's till the land up together. Let's bury some of the parts of our hard story that needs to die so that the new can grow. And so we planted this garden, and actually four gardens now. And it was a whole year that passed until we finally saw a monarch in our garden, and she laid eggs right in front of us.
Aww.
And it was just a couple searches on Instagram and YouTube and Google that I realized that only 1 to 5 out of every 100 monarch eggs laid in the wild makes it to a butterfly.
Is that
because
right?
They have so many predators.
Uh-huh.
Humans being probably the top one, but they also have a lot of natural predators.
Gotcha.
So when you bring them inside, I really have like a 80 to 90% success rate where I am able to bring them inside. I refill the milkweed leaves every day. I clean up a lot of caterpillar poop, and they literally emerge on my kitchen counter, and then I let them go. And so we average 200 to 400 monarchs a year.
Well,
so
thank you for doing your part, Justine.
It's ridiculous. But people love it. Like,
yes.
I post a lot of it on social media because
the butterflies.
They're so resilient.
Yes, so resilient, and just such a process, the metamorphosis that takes place,
mm-hmm.
much like us, right?
Exactly.
You know, we continue, hopefully, if we have a high growth quotient, we're going to continue to transform and just get a better version of ourselves, right?
Right.
So.
Well, and in order to grow, one of my favorite lessons from the monarch, and I write about this in my next book, like when they're caterpillars, they walk out of their old skin 4 times. It's called molting. You have to get uncomfortable. You have to do the work to grow and learn new lessons. And the grossest and coolest part about it is then they turn around and eat their skin. Because you cannot get rid of your past. You cannot get rid of your failures and your mistakes. It is your job.
It's part of you.
It's part of you. And it's our job to make them work for us.
Mm-hmm.
So like whether or not in business or our family life, learn your lessons. Open your eyes when you're on the bottom of the arena floor, when you are in the ashes of a failure. And learn the lessons and make it work for you and not against you.
Mm-hmm.
That's resilience.
I love that.
So even that's just one of the many.
One of the many lessons. Oh, my goodness. And who would have thought?
I know.
But, oh, wow.
It is like the weirdest thing ever. But
I love it. So, Justine, you wrote The Complicated Gray. And I've read most of that book. And I've told you that there are times where I was laughing. And then, seriously, there were times where I was weeping.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really, you know, just caused me to weep is when you would talk about being in a room full of girlfriends that you've known for a very long time, and nothing against them, you know,
nope.
but they're talking about their children, they're talking about feeding schedules, they're talking about all of this, and you said you felt invisible.
Mm-hmm.
You were the invisible one at the table. And I remember, you know, you saying you came home, you know, you talked to Chad, and you were a mess. That broke my heart because I know there are a lot of people that feel invisible.
Infertile or not.
It doesn't have to be infertility.
No.
You know, there are people, and, you know, we've talked about this, that, you know, the thing that we're all trying to do is, you know, the buzz is diversity and inclusion, but they're two different things. So tell the listening audience, how can we build more empathy into our vernacular? How can we build that more into our DNA? And again, sometimes we have a special needs child. And I remember when she was born, you know, people would say things that were really hurtful, like, I'm sorry. And I'm like, oh, no. There's nothing to be sorry about. She is perfectly and wonderfully made. But sometimes it is not what I want to say. It's not being malicious with people.
No.
It's not that at all. Sometimes it is education. Sometimes it is just building the awareness into people. I think it's sometimes better to not say anything than to say something that can be so hurtful, right? So you've said people would say things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a almost 40-year-old woman. And so first question I get everywhere I go, how many kids do you have? And because I'm an advocate for unspoken shame and breaking the silence, I will say we tried really hard to have kids. We can't have kids. And I work and receive other ways to parent in this world because that is one of my big values.
Mm-hmm.
And so I usually get one or two responses. Why don't you just try another round of IVF or just adopt?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to put the quick fix on it. I want to take away someone's pain because their pain is making me uncomfortable, right? So we put a simple answer out there. We fix it. And we all do this. It's not malicious. It's just our discomfort with vulnerability. Or I get the, oh, you poor thing. I just can't imagine. So that's sympathy. And so I can even tie this back all the way to my back surgeries. Like, I didn't need anyone to fix it. There's nothing that they could have said to fix it.
Yes.
There's nothing that you can say that would bring my three babies here and I would know who they would be at 7 years old. There's nothing you can say. I just need you to sit beside me and say, this sucks. Mm-hmm. This is hard. I don't know what to say. I'm here. But we've been really trained in our society to have simple answers, quick fixes, band-aids, or to feel pity, because that's actually what we think people want and need. But in all of those things, those are armors. Those are actually disconnection. No one feels seen when you say, I'm so sorry. I just can't imagine. They are sitting by themselves, even more alone in their struggle. Mm-hmm. This is in death. This is with a diagnosis. This is with infertility. This is with a failure at work, whatever it might be. They feel even more alone. Mm-hmm. And healing and growth and innovation will never, ever take place in disconnection. It mm-hmm. only takes place in connection. And empathy is required of that.
Very good. Well, I tell you what, I am so excited about doing a deeper dive with this when we come back. But we'll be back with Justine Froelker.
As a business leader, you know that keeping a solid first impression with your potential clients, customers, and talent is vital to reaching your organization's goals. If you haven't optimized your website, or if you don't even have a website, you're missing an opportunity to shape your first impression so that it shows your brand in the best possible light. If you're thinking about revolutionizing your website, let's talk. Our team at Technology Partners is ready to help you reshape your online presence. Go to tpi.co/websites and start your journey today.
So, Justine, I want to do a deeper dive because we had talked about it a little bit before. And I said, you know, the thing that really broke my heart is when you were talking about people, you feeling invisible and feeling not included. And I want to do a deeper dive on that. So I think empathy is one of those things that we're lacking a lot of. And I want you to talk a little bit more. How can we do better? How can we do better
right.
in our families, in our workplaces, in our communities, wherever? If we're out with friends, how can we do better?
So I think a lot of people will say, well, I'm just not empathic. I'm not a very empathic person. But what we know, especially from Brené's research, from this work that I teach, the Dare to Lead work, we know that this is a skill that we can teach. It's also measurable and observable. And when it comes to empathy, so first, let's define it. Mm-hmm. If you're a human being, you have feelings. If you don't have feelings, that's sociopathology. And we'll
that's a different, that's
yeah,
another episode.
That will hook you up with a good referral list. You know, yeah. So like, but we have feelings. If you have felt sad, mad, in grief, angry, you are equipped and can learn the skill of empathy 100%. You don't get to say, no, nah, just not my thing. I don't know how. You're equipped for it. But a lot of times we just struggle to lean into it because it is uncomfortable. It requires you to get vulnerable. So sympathy. I feel for you. I feel sorry for you. Disconnection. Empathy, I feel with you. It's connection. It is identifying with the emotions that are underneath the experience. I don't need you to have lost three babies and gone through infertility or had two back surgeries to know what grief, sadness, loss, the need for forgiveness, bitterness might feel like. You're human. You just need to pull on your experiences, get curious enough to lean into the vulnerability of the emotion and sit beside me and say something as simple as, that's really hard. That sounds brutal. I don't know what to say right now, which is really vulnerable, right? Not to lay on a quick fix, a simple answer. That's empathy. And what empathy does, why I love my big story that I've been gifted to teach it, is that I want to make sure that no one comes into contact with me and walks away feeling unseen. And that is in the skill of empathy. I mean, can you imagine a world where everyone goes to work and feels seen and heard and known? That you actually feel seen in your friend group, seen in your family? Because a lot of us don't even feel seen there, you know? And so I think that's the biggest reason why I'm so passionate about teaching the skill of empathy. But we have to rumble with almost like our pride and our ego, because we have to get willing to get curious, lean into the vulnerability. We also have to be willing to feel pretty powerless. Because if
it's uncomfortable,
it is like,
it's, I mean, really,
if I can slap a quick fix or solution on your problem, that makes me feel powerful. That makes me feel like I'm contributing. When I have to say, or when I need to say, this is really hard. Yeah. You feel seen in that.
Right. It's not about you at that point and you feeling like you're making a contribution. It's about thinking about that other person, what they need at that point in time.
Right.
I mean, really, I mean, I've often heard empathy is really putting yourself in the other person's shoes.
Yep.
So even if I have not experienced infertility, what I do is I go back into my background and I pull out something that's happened that caused a lot of grief.
Yeah.
And I go back and jump into that, and then I can feel empathy then.
Yep. Let's sit beside one another and that, oh man, this did not turn out how I wanted. We all know that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, I'm going to challenge you in that you're not being brave enough with your life.
I love that.
You know, and loving wholeheartedly and leading wholeheartedly.
Right. So I want to jump into one of the things. So you talked about if you're a human being, you have had feelings. If you haven't, then that's a different episode.
Right.
And we have some, you know, recommendations for you.
Yep.
But, you know, you talk a lot about the permission of the and, okay? And I love it because I think I even saw something like where you had talked about when you're little, you know, it's like you've got the happy face, you've got the fearful face, you've got the sad face and the angry face, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But now you say it's the emoji.
Yeah, I know. Now we have all the emojis. And it's so funny. My friends always joke, they're like, did you mean to send that emoji? I was like, I know I'm a therapist, but I feel like I always literally have to Google what the emojis mean. I don't understand how they're matching up to the emotions.
Right.
But like there's, and my first TED Talk, The Permission of the And, I've even expanded on the concept since then, but like the complicated gray, the permission of the and, it is this space between, it's the tension that we must live in. It's the muck between what we have been taught is two opposing emotions or experiences. I believe in what I have seen throughout these, especially last 7 years of my life of resilient recovery, is when I give myself permission to feel uncomfortable and feel all the feelings, it is actually there that my clarity and my healing lie, that I am happy and sad. I feel grief and joy, that I am a mother who doesn't get to parent her kids here, and I will work every day to receive ways to parent the world. And so it's the permission of the and. And when I did that TED Talk, we're coming up on 2 years now, it was more of this like place. And then it started trickling in. People started using it against me. I'm just in the and. I'm just feeling the and. And I was like, oh, no. This is not a place to stay stuck. This is a tool. Mm-hmm. This is a tool. Give yourself permission for the and. Identify the struggle with grace. Cope with it in an effective way and allow it to move through so you can write the ending to your story. Mm-hmm. That's resiliency.
Yes.
That's turning your hard parts of your story, mm-hmm. your failures, your mess ups, when you hurt people, when you're just human, because you're going to be, into the big parts of your story. And the permission of the and is a tool to help you do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's uncomfortable.
Yes. I love your wisdom. I love your insight. And the thing is, Justine, if you had not gone through what you went through, you would not have this to share with other people.
Yeah.
And people need this. Mm-hmm. They really do.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, this is something extra.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that. So, you know, tell us about the Something Extra on one of your team members.
It's been interesting because my businesses are so, I was self-employed for so long.
Yes.
I do a network marketing kind of on the side that has funded the last year of my life to write and teach and do more speaking and things like that. But there's this piece that as I have retired from seeing individual clients, to risk to write the next book, to teach more of Brené's work in ministry, things like that. I've also had kind of a crumbling of my own team in my side business. But there's this piece of ownership that's happening, and it's this ownership of like, I don't have space for this right now, and this is what I can do. There's this piece, I think I see a lot in business, where people just keep plowing forward and hustling, and they're wondering why they're so burnt out, or why they crash, or why their body gives up, or why they're not inventing new things, when in reality, do we need this grace-filled permission to struggle and set boundaries and own all the parts of our story, which right now might be a season like, I can't do this, you know, and how vulnerable is that?
Right. I mean, and that is a very difficult place to get
it
to.
Is.
But a mentor of mine years ago said, you know, if you build no margin, it's never going to happen because you're just going to continue, like you said, plowing forward and you're not going to pull back and take that opportunity to try something new, you know?
Yep.
I love that. So tell us a little bit about a story where you've seen something missing in you. Have you seen something missing in you?
Oh, for sure.
No, you're perfect.
I love that this work has changed my life. And when I combine it with things like the four agreements, take nothing personally, I need to own my stuff. Own this and of what is in my control and what's not in my control. And take nothing personally. It has been one of the most powerful things, especially in the last year of building what I'm building in the speaking and the workshops and things like that, of getting rejections, not being the right fit, having contracts changed on me, or having people disappoint you and say, like, that's not how I would do it. It's not about you. And for me to kind of, it's always this like extra piece for me to kind of stop, always practicing empathy. I am not in their life. That is their life. And it's not about me. My second TED Talk, it's a much funnier and shorter TED Talk, but I talk about how like 99% of your response to someone is about your stuff. It's not about them. Which also means that my response to you is about my stuff. And that's responsibility to change our life. And it's also freedom to be who we are. But it's the permission for both, you know, and that to take ownership for all of it, to stop finger pointing and blaming and not taking responsibility and coming alongside people and saying, this is my part. Can you tell me more about where you're coming from? Help me understand this. Mm-hmm. Let's sit beside one another, even if we look different, believe different, think different, and understand one another.
Right.
But we all have to own our stuff to do that.
Yeah, there was a situation last week with a workshop that I just sat in. I was a little fly on the wall because I just kind of wanted to see what was happening. And they were talking. Well, I walked in right when they were given a scenario. They said, what if you're in a meeting? What if you're in a meeting with a person? And one of your team members comes to you after the meeting and says to you, every time we're in a meeting together, I feel like you undermine me, you know, and instead of getting defensive, you know, they talked about jumping in with empathy and saying, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to make you feel that way. Let's talk about how I can do better.
Yes. Like lean into that curiosity. Can you tell me more about what am I doing? What am I saying? Mm-hmm. Because so much of it is like our body language, our facial expression, or did you say something with a tone that was not what was meant, but we all are making up our own story.
Yes, we are.
But we have to be willing to be courageous and say like, the story I'm making up is that like, you don't believe in me. You're dismissing me in front of everyone and it's really hurting my feelings or it's making me mad. Can we talk about this?
We need to do part two and come up with all kinds of scenarios.
All of these languages. I know the language of this work is so powerful.
Yes, it is. So Justine, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
It's the tools and it's the words and it's the language. It's okay to have a bit of a script. You know, to take mantras like I give myself permission to struggle and I'm going to be accountable. I'm going to own my stuff. It's the language of the story I'm making up and I'm going to get curious and or I'm going to really kind of stop myself when I want to jump in and rescue someone and say, that sounds really hard. I'm here. It's the language and the tools.
The tools. It's
to
so
show
important
up.
To have the right tools in your tool belt.
Yep. To be courageous and to live brave and daring and authentic. Authentic's such a buzzword now. And yet it's become such a buzzword that no one quite knows what it means. Right. But I'm super passionate about teaching you how to do it and the tools and the language.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Very good. I love it. Well, tell me this. Is there anything that's coming up that you want to talk to the audience about? Do you want to talk about Complicated Gray? I know you've got some workshops that are coming up through AIM. If anyone is a member of AIM, or even if you're not a member, I think you can still go to workshops.
Yeah.
How would they find those, Justine, if they were interested in?
Everything's on my website. So JustineFroelker.com. I am very embarrassingly easy to find on social media. but I use it as the tool it was meant to be, which is to inspire and teach and connect. So I'm easy to find there. Books are always great to sell and be reviewed because that's how people discover me. But what I love teaching the Dare to Lead work. And the cool part is I really can piecemeal it out to whatever somebody wants or needs, whether or not it's the vulnerability lesson. Yeah, or Rumble lesson. But I do have lots of full trainings coming up, because what we offer now is that when you sit for the 16-hour training, no matter how we piece that out, you then get a certificate to be Dare to Lead trained.
Right.
And can put that on LinkedIn and things like that. And
sure.
It's just being able to say, like, I know what the skill sets of courage is. Like, I know how to practice and speak courage and lead from that wholehearted mm-hmm. and daring, authentic place.
Mm-hmm.
And
awesome
I'm
work.
Good at teaching it, and I love it. So that's really what I really want people to know about, because not a lot of people know about this work yet.
Right. Well, they will.
It's
they
coming.
Will now.
It's coming.
Well, Justine, this has just been a delight. So much fun.
Thank
I think you.
You
and I could sit here for hours,
because yeah.
I love our conversations. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We so appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc. 2019. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.